Peach really gets at the conflict, the controversy that our society has when it comes to alcohol. Is it appropriate to drink it, good and bad? And that's what we're tackling today. It's a pretty big topic and something I really think is going to be a great, great weekend. And to do that, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm going to interview a friend of mine, Jack Wilson, who is a PhD in counseling psychology. He's taught in this area and trained in this area of substance abuse for over 30 years. And every time I sit with Jack, and you're going to find the same thing today, there's just wisdom from his life and from his training and teaching. So we decided to bring him in and say, let's talk about this issue of alcohol. So first question, Jack, would be this. You know the whiskey speech. You brought it to us. So there's that debate of good and bad. How do you look at this whole thing in alcohol in our society?
Yeah, that's the reason I really like that particular speech, because it does do such a good job of summing up, you know, all the ways of looking at alcohol and the ways our society looks at it. And I really believe both sides are correct. If you are a moderate user of alcohol, if you don't have a physiological predisposition where it becomes dangerous to you, I have no objections to appropriate use of alcohol. But we have to always be cognizant and aware that there are individuals out there for whom, because of a variety of different factors which we'll talk about, it's simply not safe for them to consume alcohol. But we don't want to just talk about the individual who has the problem with alcohol. We also want to make sure that we take a look at the impact that it has on their family, because this becomes a spiritual issue, a moral issue that has great impact on everybody around the person who is doing the drinking, all the way out to the larger society.
What are the stats? I mean, what kind of, you know, what's going on in our culture right now in regards to alcohol, in families, individuals, whatever?
Well, what we know is the approximate percentage that most professionals are comfortable with is 15% of the population have serious issues when they consume alcohol. It's a little tricky, though. I said 15% of the population, but that doesn't address people who don't drink. There are a lot of people out there who don't drink, and they're not in our statistics in terms of problem drinkers. But what we do know is individuals, let's say from within that 15% who have difficulty with alcohol, 35% of them, fully 35% of them, would fit any definition of alcoholism that we could possibly come up with.
Now, how would you define an alcoholic?
Well, there's always been a lot of argument, and I even think it's a canard, about whether the alcoholism is a disease or is not. And I'm just going to say, yes, it is. I don't want to take a lot of time on that. But it is a disease, and it's a disease that is characterized by a loss of control. It's progressive, and if it continues through its progression, it's fatal. Let me give you an example. What I mean by that is society, much like the whiskey speech, we're confused. We have an image of an alcoholic as being the derelict, the skid row bum. That's not the typical alcoholic. Alcoholism exists on a continuum from an individual because of some predisposition is beginning to develop the disease, and that's where we want to step in, that's where we want to have an impact.
Which blows the myth, because the college guy who can drink everybody under the table is the stud. You're the man because you can hold more alcohol, and you're saying that guy or that gal is actually in more trouble than the guy who can't drink a beer or two.
Yeah. The other thing that we see is people who won't go or won't be involved in a social activity or an event unless alcohol is served. The guy that won't play on the slow pitch team, you know, or the girl that won't go to the party. Just think of all the things you've heard, you and Ann have sat in a room when you're doing premarital counseling, the debate over serving or not serving alcohol at the reception. Well, if we don't serve alcohol at the reception, my uncles won't come.
Exactly.
Okay. See the power, you know, that culture begins to exhibit and how normative it becomes. Well, whenever I hear those kinds of things, then as a professional, I start going, we better ask some more questions here, because it looks to me like we're beginning to move into the area of significant alcohol abuse.
Yeah. When does a person decide it would be safe for me or it would not be safe for me to even become a social drinker, maybe?
What I would say for you as an individual or for anybody listening to this, do your own family tree. Go back at least two or three generations and look around to see whether there have been some folks that the family referred to as problem drinkers or Uncle Ned couldn't really handle his booze. Or, you know, and the closer it is to you, the more at risk you are of being in that 15% of people for whom alcohol can be a serious problem. So if one or more of your parents would be someone that you would think of that didn't handle alcohol well, you know, created confusion in the family life because of it, then I would say that's a point at which you should be seriously considering the way you use alcohol.
Yeah.
Well, let's push that a little bit. What does that mean? Well, what that means is that if you have one or more parent who is an alcoholic, you have a 5 times higher probability of having the predisposition to this disease than someone who doesn't.
So I've heard you talk about the 3 P's. You just mentioned one of them. What are the other P's that you think of when you dig around your family tree?
Well, you when you're digging around and taking a look at things, you want to see what precipitates, you know, your drinking, and that's the culture that you grew up in. It's the advertising. It's the billions of dollars that we have in media. Frankly, I think most people in the room would agree the best and funniest TV ads, you know, are the alcohol ads.
They are the best.
They do a great job. But that's all part of the precipitating thing in terms of that we as a culture say it's okay. We have some of the least restrictive laws as it relates to public drunkenness. We have some of the least restrictive laws as it comes to drunken driving. Most of the other countries in the world are nowhere near as tolerant. That's a precipitating issue. And then the next issue becomes the perpetuation of the issue. You know, are you going to continue doing it? And when we look at perpetuating, we come to another diagnostic category, which is extremely important, and it's really kind of the capstone category, and that's, do you continue drinking in spite of negative consequences? If you have had a couple of negative consequences and you cut way back, stop drinking, don't drink at all, become what we would call a moderate drinker, then that's something that you've made as a good judgment. But if you have something in your genetic makeup, then the likelihood is that you're going to continue drinking in spite of the negative consequences.
So, I mean, this whole series we're in called Crave, that would apply to any one of the craves we talked about, food, sex, today talking about alcohol. Why does a person, from your perspective, who has negative consequences with drinking or any of the others, continue to do it?
Your brain's actually changed. And your brain is set up in such a fashion or a condition that it craves the alcohol. And we refer to it as the point at which you tip over. And I can't tell you for any individual when that tip over point's going to come. I'm a very strong believer that many people are born alcoholic because they're 2 ounces, 3 ounces in the womb, and their mom has a beer every day. Whoops. That's a tremendous amount of alcohol. And if you have any element of precipitation in there, so many, many young people start their life that way.
Yeah. But as I look back on my past, it's like, okay, so I'm in college deciding to drink and realizing in myself this, what would you call it, this desire to not have 2 beers, to go to the third and the fourth. Every time I drank, it was never one. It was always like, let's go farther. But until I heard you talk about this, I never connected dots like predisposition. You know, my past, thinking almost every single night of my life from 5, 6, 7, 8 years old to 17, 18 years old, always seeing mom and dad with a glass of vodka or gin every night. So, you know, for someone like me, if I came into you and said, hey, Jack, do you think I should drink? What advice would you give a guy like me?
The advice that I would give you is to remember the Paisley song does a really good job of talking about the personality of alcohol. And the personality of alcohol is it's cunning, it's baffling, it's powerful, and it's infinitely patient. The fastest growing segment of people that fit the diagnosis of alcoholism today are people over the age of 55. And it's going up faster up in each age group beyond that. We have the two groups that we're most concerned about in terms of getting information out there, and that's the young, you know, and the folks over 55. So I know you're not over 55, but I would think with your family tree, it just is something that I would say, don't do it.
Yeah. Well, you know, the amazing thing in my story, and I'm guessing a lot of people this weekend, light bulbs are going on right now. You may have your schedule full of people coming in, but you know, just connecting some of the dots, it's like, I never was told this, never thought, okay, so I had an alcoholic mom and dad that would, you know, I'm like, I'm not them. Even though it split up our home, I'm not them, I can handle it. And so I made a decision based on just wise counsel to not have alcohol in my home. It just is like, duh. Mm-hmm. Now, I know there's some people probably sitting out there going, well, I didn't have alcoholic parents, I can handle it. What do you say to them? Maybe they can. Is that what you say? Or?
Well, I'd say to them, take a look at your life.
Yeah.
Is the consumption of alcohol getting in your way? Is it interfering? If it's getting in your way, if it's interfering, if it's causing problems in your marriage, if it's causing problems at work, then I would ask you to do a simple little thing. Now remember, simple and easy aren't synonyms, okay? But I'm going to ask you to do a simple little thing. Don't drink for 30 days.
At all?
At all. And as you make the decision to be free of alcohol for 30 days, take a look to see how you feel about that. Hmm. Okay? And if at the end of that 30 days, talk to someone who has background or experience in the area, and you may come to the conclusion that, yeah, things are okay. Or you may come to the conclusion, I had a little bit more of an issue here than I thought that I did.
Now talk about the person that's affected by alcohol in their home or in a friendship or a relationship at work, that they're not the one drinking, but they're living close in a relationship or, you know, some kind of relationship with somebody that is. What do they do? How do they make a difference? How do they help this person see? Can they? Or they just throw up their hands like this and say, there's nothing I can do?
The biggest thing that that I really want people to take home is that term hostage. It sounds almost brutal, okay? But I want the people to take home the word hostage, and I want them to do an evaluation of themselves. Have they and the rest of the family become hostage to alcohol? And that's the first step. If you accept the fact that you truly are not in a relationship with this person, you're just simply hostage to their alcohol, that'll cause a mind change almost immediately. From there, then, there are a variety of different things. You know, our recovery groups here on Monday nights do a really good job of helping people whose lives have been made unmanageable because of somebody else's drinking. There's Al-Anon for people. Al-Anon's an amazing group that was actually started by the wife of the guy who created Alcoholics Anonymous because she wasn't real sure what to do once he got into recovery because she'd been codependent, co-alcoholic, whatever term you want to use, for so many years that she also had stopped growing and stopped maturing. So it's really important to spend time with people who've been down the road, you know, who've been there in front of you, and to get their wise counsel.
So that community aspect is huge. I mean, we've said it every week in this series, but hopefully people hear that, to go to a safe place where other people know the struggle and can share with you and go forward, hopefully, right?
Correct.
So many people that drink don't think they have a problem, so they're not willing to admit they have a problem. What do you do with a person like that, especially if that's somebody you're in a relationship with?
Well, let me just say one thing that, again, might be controversial, but I've been doing this for 30 years.
You're good at the controversial.
I've never met an alcoholic who didn't know they were an alcoholic. Mm. It's just that they haven't been willing to face it yet. It's just that they haven't been willing to turn it over.
Okay. So you're saying deep in their soul, they know there's a problem here.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah. But the personality of the hostage taker is so strong that it blocks them from doing anything about it. My experience is that people who are the low bottoms, the folks that are not at the physiological dependency level yet, which is not necessarily a synonym there, so I want to be careful. Yes, there are low bottoms that need to be detoxed. But the low bottoms seem to be willing to accept a recommendation or a suggestion that they go to an AA meeting. What a great place to start. If you think you're beginning to have issues and concerns with alcohol, AA is, it's everywhere. Three meetings a day at least, you know, and places all over.
Yeah.
So if someone tells you they can't get to an AA meeting, whoops, sure they can.
Yeah.
They're everywhere. And what a wonderful place to start in terms of beginning to get an idea in terms of looking at life, you know, without alcohol. That's the part of it. The issue in terms of the family and the people who are concerned and affected, you asked me about the wife or the husband. You should hold that person accountable for their conduct. And if you are a wife or husband and you are committed in the sickness and health, and yet this is a disease, then I think that a very important step is some form of an intervention. some form of bringing people together who can sit down with the individual and honestly say to that individual, this is the way your drinking is negatively affecting my life. You know, this is the way your drinking is getting in the way of us being able to move forward as a family. You know? And a variety of people can and should be involved. Most folks who talk about the recovery process will tell you that that hearing from their coworkers and their bosses was a much more powerful thing than hearing from members of their family.
Really?
You know, there are people out there now through the different services that are mentioned in the materials we're giving out who have intervention specialists on staff who can teach you how to do a beginning stage intervention, who actually can come in and run an intervention in your home for you if it's something that you would prefer to have a professional do.
Yeah, because it sounds to the typical person pretty scary to think that I would confront my dad or my spouse without a little help. Like you said, with some skilled professionals or people at least have done it. Have you seen those done? Some kind of intervention, like you said, it's better to have just more than just family members there. Do you see success?
If there's a plan.
Really?
There has to be a plan. If I say to you, I'm concerned about your, you know, your use of alcohol, and I don't have a plan, I wasted your time and my time. I may even have raised the risk for you. So I have to be in a situation where, and that's where, you know, talking to an intervention specialist, I have to be in a situation where someone who is a recovering person can say, and as soon as this is over, I want you to go to this AA meeting with me. Or the intervention specialist can say, and this is the treatment program we're recommending for you. We already have the airplane ticket. You're on your way to wherever, you know, or I'll drive you there myself, or I want to take you to the emergency room to start the detoxing process, because there needs to be a plan right there so that the individual can see that it wasn't just smoke, because she's been told so often, stop drinking, stop drinking.
Yeah.
We want this to actually be an intervention.
Wow.
And the intervention needs to be honest, but you need to use common sense in the intervention. But you also have to have compassion, because I don't know anybody who wants to be an alcoholic. No 5-year-old or 15-year-old or 55-year-old said, "Oh, I think I'll wake up tomorrow and destroy my life." What a great idea!
Yeah.
No, so you have to. I've seen this kill so many people. The compassion grows out of knowing that individual is lonely, they're isolated, and they really want help. And the compassion also operates along the line, there's good news. People by the tens of thousands gain control over this disease and go on to lead full, beautiful, balanced lives.
So what happened there? Are you seeing people that you've watched, worked with? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's...
But Dave, I was seeing the successful ones too.
Yeah.
Not just the ones that fail.
Right. That's good.
That's, you know, cheers of both.
Yeah.
Joy and sorrow.
Yeah.
For the last 4 years, I've had the pleasure of getting to know Jack. Jack has mentored my wife and I before we were married. Still does. He is the staff psychologist here, and so rightly I see him on a weekly basis. But he's also mentored Steve, Dave Wilson, myself, and a ton of other leaders here at the church. And in all of the times that I have sat across the table from him, I've never seen him cry. I've never even seen him choke up. And you saw that. That came out of nowhere. He just broke down. And you just saw him break down because of the amount of people that he has seen held hostage because of this disease, this craving. And every one of us in this room has experienced at some level alcoholism, whether it is us individually or it is friends or family members that we have. We have dealt with it or will have to deal with it. I can remember the first day I walked through these doors at Kensington. I was totally hungover. And I walked in and I came right down there. And I sat in the fourth row, hungover, ready to vomit at any point in time. And Steve Anders came over to me and started pointing at me and spitting. He spits sometimes when he teaches, right? That made me want to throw up even more. But I sat there hungover listening about this Jesus for the first time. And up to that point in time, I had been a really good pre-law student and got into one of the best law schools in the nation. But what people didn't know about me, at least most, is that on a regular, probably every other night basis, I was drinking somewhere between 6 beers up to, and most of the time, a fifth of liquor. And so I can stand here and tell you that because of my past, because of my family, I am predisposed to alcoholism. And so it has to be at the forefront of my mind always. And I know, and I've learned this over the last 2 or 3 years, that the moment I stop worrying about it is the moment that I start taking a step towards this path of destruction. And it doesn't matter that I'm in ministry, and it doesn't matter that most of you in this room are upper middle class Oakland County citizens. You and I, we got to get the stereotypical wino out of our minds as we talk about this. Because this disease affects everyone and affects those that you would never think are battling this on a day-to-day basis. Last week, Dave and I sat down with two women, Jean and Mary, their sisters. And we talked about their husbands, Mike and Eugene, who were both alcoholics. And as I walked out of the meeting, I closed the door on Dave and these two women, and I did exactly what Jack did. I just broke down. I just broke down weeping. And over the last 5 years, both of their husbands have died because of the disease. Mike, this first picture that you're going to see, died at 38. These are his twin baby girls. And you look at that picture, and it is the average, you know, good-looking, middle-class, hard-working guy. And Jean, his wife, read this to us the other day and wrote this to alcoholism after he passed away. "You have destroyed my family. You've taken the man that I married nearly 10 years ago, and you turned him into a complete stranger, a cruel, mean, heartless stranger. He can only focus on one thing, alcohol. He can't focus on his two beautiful daughters. You've stolen that from him. You've stolen their father from them. They never know a healthy father. You came into our lives and took all of the normal, healthy bonds that exist in a family, and you drowned them. And for that, I feel complete hatred for you." When he was dying in his hospital bed, he looked at Jean and he said, "Well, at least now Eugene, his brother-in-law, at least now he knows he has to stop drinking." 3 months ago, his brother-in-law and good friend died of alcoholism. He watched him die, and Eugene still could not beat the disease. And this is a picture of him. Those are his two boys. And Mary wrote this after he died. "Because of the bottle, my boys only had their father for 8 and 10 years. Because of the bottle, I must raise these boys without their father. Because of the bottle, these boys will never have the chance to learn how to be a man from their father, nor will they learn to cook from him or paint or fish from him. Because of the bottle, my boys don't have a daddy at their baseball games, school events, band concerts. Because of the bottle, my boys were cheated out of the opportunity to witness a lifelong healthy relationship between a man and a woman, a husband and a wife, and their daddy and mommy. Because of the bottle, this world lost was cheated out of one of the most unique, talented, funny, compassionate, loving men God ever created. We lost him because of the bottle. Because of the shame attached to that bottle, that man would not, could not, did not get the help he needed soon enough. The bottle took these two men's lives. The bottle drastically changed the rest of Gene and Mary's lives. And the repercussions will be felt for the rest of the kids' lives. And Jack made it extremely clear that because of predisposition or a family history, and because there is an enemy that longs to keep you away from the freedom that Jesus Christ created you for, drinking is like playing Russian roulette. It's like playing Russian roulette. If you do not have awareness, if you are not experiencing true, real, genuine community, and if you do not have the hope and the life of Jesus Christ within you, drinking is like putting a gun up to your head and pulling the trigger, not knowing if it's loaded or not. And Mike and Eugene and thousands of others each year start a pattern that leads them away from the dads or the moms or the image bearers of the holy living God that they were created to be, and down a path that leads to death. They pull the trigger. That's what happens. Now again, there is a big difference between drinking and this disease. The word wine is found in the scriptures actually more than the word hell. It is. You look at the first recorded miracle of Jesus and he turns water into what? Into what? Wine. But church people, they hate to enter into this tension. And so you'll go through life and you'll hear pastors and ministers say, well, when they use the word wine in the Bible, they're not really meaning wine. Like, what do they mean, pony? Like, they're meaning wine. Wine, alcohol, was a huge part of society in the history of the church. John Calvin, one of the most influential followers of Jesus, was given his salary by his congregation to be a pastor, but every year was also comped with 250 gallons of wine. So that he could throw parties where he would share a glass of wine with somebody as he talked to him about Jesus. I mean, this is a huge part of the history of the Christian church and the movement of Jesus followers. There's a huge difference between drinking and the disease that ruins people's lives. But in order for us to have the discernment and the wisdom that is needed in this area of life, for us to treat this as something that has the potential to kill instead of just some social norm, we have to have three specific things in our lives. Three things must be present. Two of them, which Jack already touched on. But the first is awareness, right? We must be aware that many of us could be predisposed to this addiction. Mike and Eugene, they didn't know when they took their first drink at 14 that they were predisposed to alcohol. They didn't understand it. I didn't get it. When I was 14, I did not understand that I was already predisposed. You have to ask yourself the question and search your family tree like Jack said. Have your parents or grandparents, aunts and uncles, do they drink on a regular basis in an unhealthy way? Because if they do, you are five times greater being predisposed to this addiction. You have a five times greater chance to actually being addicted to alcohol. You have to be aware of stats. Right now, there are some staggering stats out that those that have their first drink at the age of 14 or younger are 50% greater to become alcoholics than those that wait until they're 21. You have to be aware that there is this huge gap between a parent's perception of their children and the reality of the kids. Researchers are saying that now in our day, most kids are having their first taste of liquor or beer or wine in fifth or sixth grade. And so researchers pulled back and they asked both the kids who were drinking and their parents why. And most of the parents answered this, that their fifth or sixth grader were drinking because of peer pressure or because they just wanted to experiment. And then they pull back and they ask the kids who are actually drinking why. And you know what most fifth graders and sixth graders said? Because we wanted to get drunk. And you know where most of that liquor and beer and wine came from, right? The parents' home. I run into parents all the time, and there's some of you out here right now that go, well, my kid's not dealing with this, my kid's not dealing with that, they're really naive. If you find that coming out of your mouth, your kid's probably not the naive one. You have to be aware that right now, more than ever in our history, the rate of women who are becoming addicted to alcohol is higher than ever. You have to be aware of the millions of dollars that the media uses to create this false perception of social drinking. I mean, we watch television shows and movies where guys stop for their lunch break at work and sit down and have a good meal and 6 ounces of scotch on a regular basis. That doesn't happen. That's not okay, right? We watch movies where the working class moms and dads get home from work and doing their thing and sit down on the couch with a glass of whiskey on a daily basis, and they're all right. That's not reality. We have to be aware about our nationality, our ethnicity. Who in here? Let me see hands. Irish. Who's got some Irish blood in them? Yes. What about, keep them up, keep them up. What about Native American? African American, Hispanic descent, Polish, Russian, keep the hands up, German. All right, look around. All of you right now have a better chance of being predisposed to alcohol than those with their hands down. We think that it's a stereotype when we laugh about the Irish. It's not funny, it's reality. You have to be aware. And until we are aware of our family background, drinking is like playing Russian roulette. The second thing that we have to have in our lives is community. We absolutely need people in our lives that truly love us, that ask us the tough questions, that are not afraid of being uncomfortable, and that are willing to step on our toes. And we need to be those kinds of people to them as well. It's not always fun having people speak honestly in your lives, but it is one of the necessary steps to experiencing the freedom that Jesus Christ talks about. Mal Panko says, the truth will set you free, but first it's probably going to piss you off. Isn't that true? And as I sat down with Mary this past week, she just started to weep as she read the second quote. Love is a commitment to one's long-term good, not their short-term comfort. And for years, both her and her sister Jean did not take their husband's drinking as serious as they could have. And they realize now that what is easy usually does not equate to love. Love is not concerned with what people want. Love exhausts itself over what people need. And a ton of you wives in this room today, and a ton of you husbands in this room today, you are going to listen to this message, you are going to hear Jack, and you are going to get in the car, and for one of the first times, you are going to want to ask a question about your partner, your spouse's drinking habits. Or maybe for one of the first times, you want to open up dialogue and ask questions about your own drinking habit. And as you do that, I can promise you this will happen to so many of you in this room. There will be this feeling that comes over you where you almost refuse to open up because you are afraid of offending them, or you're afraid of stepping on their toes, or maybe you're worried that you're going to burden them with some of the issues you want to talk about. And you have to understand that true love is not comfortable, and that there is an enemy who wants to keep this kind of stuff in the dark. Over the past 5 weeks, it's odd to say this, but it has been a blessing to see so many people take advantage of our Celebrate Recovery ministry on Monday nights here. People are understanding that there is a safe community where you can walk into and talk to people who are going through the same exact things you are going through. Where there are people who are family members or friends of people who are going through the same thing that you are going through. And I'd encourage you, man, find that community here if you have to. Unless there is real awareness and true community in your life, drinking is like playing Russian roulette. The last thing is this. We must have Jesus. Hands down. We must have Jesus. The scripture makes it very clear why drinking inappropriately is so devastating, not just to us, but to the people around us. Ephesians 5, a Jesus follower named Paul says this, "Do not get drunk on wine, And he doesn't follow with don't get drunk on wine because it's bad for your liver, or don't get drunk on wine because there's people that'll look at you in negative ways. He says don't get drunk on wine because it leads to debauchery. And you look at the definition of debauchery, and debauchery actually means to be seduced away from allegiance. Seduction from allegiance or virtue. And when you start to read this verse in the context of the entire chapter in Ephesians, you begin to get a great picture of the heart of God and what he cares about. In the first verse of Ephesians 5, Paul writes this. He says, be imitators of God. Therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. So here's Paul going, hey, here's the mission of God. Here's what he cares about. Be imitators of him. Imitate Jesus. Be like Jesus. Follow the teachings of Jesus. Care about the things that Jesus cares about. Show the kind of love and compassion to your kids and to your neighbors and to your parents that Jesus shows. Imitating him in every way so that the world might know about his love and the sacrifice that he has made. And that kind of life, living that kind of mission, it is demanding. It demands focus and clarity and patience and strength and perseverance and resilience. So Paul goes on in the scripture and he says, be very careful then how you live, not as unwise but as wise, making the most of every opportunity because the days are evil. Paul's saying, you guys, you have a minimal amount of time to be in this world. You have a minimal amount of time to be with your kids. You have a minimal amount of time to show love to your family, to your spouse, to learn about this God that pursues you and to get to know him. You have a minimal amount of time to influence and impact people and leave a specific kind of legacy in this place. So he goes on, he says, therefore, do not be foolish, but understand what the Lord's will is. Don't get drunk on wine, which leads to debauchery. Instead, be filled with the Spirit of God. Getting drunk pulls us away from our allegiance to a God who gave his life for us. Getting drunk pulls us away from the mission of God that he so badly wants us to be immersed in. And God's mission for us is to imitate Jesus by loving God and loving people. And when we crave alcohol, when we play Russian roulette, you cannot and will not follow Jesus in freedom because you are hostage. You are held captive. And when you lose to addiction, and I hope you hear this, we sell ourselves short of the people that we are created to be. When we fall into addiction, we're depriving ourselves of the humanity and the beauty that we were created for. And we all have cravings, whether it is food or shopping or pornography or alcohol, work, approval. And we crave, and here's reality, we crave because we know this world is messed up. There's something missing. Every day I lay my head on a pillow, there is something missing. I don't know if it's because I look at how screwed up I am or how screwed up you are, but I know there's something not right and there has to be more. And so what do? We go to thousands of different things, different habits, and we become hostage to people and habits that we hope would fulfill us, never imagining the kind of control they'll have on us. But a few thousand years ago, prophets or messengers of God started to talk about one who was to come and set God's people free, the Savior. And Isaiah, a prophet, in chapter 61, he talks about him. He says, the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on him because the Lord has anointed him. He's anointed him to preach good news to the poor. He has sent him to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the captives and release from darkness for the prisoners. And then Jesus shows up on the scene and he begins to fulfill these words. Jesus is the one thing that will ultimately fulfill our craving and set us free. And to be honest, and you guys know this, it does not mean that once you say yes to imitating Jesus and following him, you're not going to fall into this craving. You're not going to fall into brokenness and imperfection. But it's about this daily process where we cling to awareness of who we are, where we've come from, and where we could go based on our past.
It's a daily process where we are in real, authentic community, asking one another the tough questions. And I pray that this place will be one of those communities where we challenge and encourage one another. And it is about a daily process where we say yes to God. We need your sacrifice by which we experience your grace and your forgiveness and are restored to the people that we were always created to be. Here's the good news about this whole series. Jesus is in the business of making things new. He's in the business of making things new. He's in the business of turning captives into image bearers of the holy living God. Jesus is in the business of turning addicts into those that will end up leading the movement of Jesus Christ in this world, giving hope to people, to kids, and those around the world that never had any. He is in the business of making things new. And he came in this world to give you and I that kind of freedom, to experience the kind of grace and love and belief he has in us, his creation. Let me pray. Father God, we come before you and thank you for who you are. We are imperfect people. And we come before you and ask that you would reveal your perfectness. That in our flaws we would see your holiness. That in our smallness we would see your bigness. You are not easy to grasp or understand, and so we ask that you would reveal your heart to us in the most clear way possible. And we love you. And we grab hold of you in hope that you can make us new again. It's in your precious name that we pray these things. And all those people said, amen.